This podcast was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for the Junior Cycle Talks channel.
Hello, I'm Mary Lowry, advisor with the Arts and Junior Cycle team. Welcome to this podcast where my guest today is Colm Keegan. Colm is an award-winning writer and he's also an experienced creative writing teacher and facilitator. Today, Colm and I are going to chat about creativity and about how he inspires and encourages creativity in others. And he will read some of his work for us. Lots to do. So let's get started, Colm.
That's quick.
I might ask you to begin by giving the listener a quick introduction to how you came to be a writer and a facilitator of creative writing.
I became a graphic designer, and at the same time, I was working in the community running a kayaking club for young people in Clondalk. And as it got to my mid-20s, that was sort of fading away, and I was becoming more like a guy that has kids and works. And it was something of an emptiness in it. And I wasn't happy, and I realised, oh yeah, like I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be creative when I was like 18, 19 as well. And as the kayaking disappeared, I started to get interested in writing. I was always a big reader. I always used to love reading. It was like I was too full of words. And then I found out that there was a writing class in the local library. So when I heard about this group, I was like, oh, I can learn some things here. And then I started trying to get into competitions, getting into the New Irish writing and stuff like that. Eventually, on that road then, I did a poem called Dear Dealer, which is like giving out to a friend who's going to get into selling drugs. And I did it at this event. And a librarian came up to me and was like, you have to come into my school. Because when I saw you doing that poem, I was like, the kids will love you. And when I went into the school, something just clicked. And I was like, this is the same thing that I used to do years ago. And in the same way I used to lead young people down rivers and throw them over waterfalls, I can lead them into creativity. I can lead them into all the personal development stuff that I really was passionate about when I was younger. And then the crash happened and I was putting a 3-day week in my job. And on the 2 days off, I was going into skills. And that was the jump. And I took that leap. And then it all just happened there. So that was like coming on 10 years ago. So that's
and you've
the road.
Been jumping ever since.
Yeah,
taking lots
so,
of
yeah,
leaps.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
My favourite thing to do is something I haven't done before.
You say, I consider designing a project a creative endeavour in itself.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about some of the creative endeavours that you have done?
Well, you know, creativity is everywhere and we define creatives. And, you know, making a building is creative. Like just deciding what way our bedroom is laid out, that's creative. You know what I mean? Like, and there's creativity is everywhere. It's always like trying to break new ground and it ends up being kind of outreach work. A lot of the stuff is government funded, like arts council work, arts office work. And it's about helping fostering creativity in the community for the betterment of the young people. And it's all using the arts to help people express themselves more. And not to use that phrase, helping people find their voice. A lot of the time it's helping people be heard because they already had a voice and we're just listening. And I think there's a bit of a shift in Ireland where people are paying a bit more attention to that now. So if we could think of two projects where I've been working with young people on a big scale like that, the first two that come into my head would be Wraparound, which has a really important role in skills, bringing spoken word and rap and poetry into the classroom and lighting that spark in young writers. And South Dublin Epic is a project I run with South Dublin Arts Office, which is using genre fiction like dystopian futures, like kind of science fiction stuff to help people be creative and make their own short stories. But they're also looking at their own agency in life and what would happen if they were challenged.
What does that look like in the classroom? How do you begin that process with the young people you work with?
I think it's about making a new space that's not like the classroom for a start. So even very basic things like just changing the layout of the room or bringing them into a library instead of the classroom, because the classroom has all of this sort of symbolic power over a person. And then like, I'm not a teacher. And one of the first things I might do is establish that true language by saying something like, oh, what's the crack? You know, and it just changes the dynamic. And when I think back to teachers, the ones that inspired me were people who are very comfortable jumping out of that classroom structure. That's always about shifting out of that syllabus and bringing people back to it in a more lateral way, you know.
Talk me through some of the exercises that you might do with students when you are working with them.
The first thing is always just to get them to look at language. So it might even be, tell me a phrase that you think I mightn't have heard of before. Or insults, there's always a great like load of insults, you know. And it's about saying to them, that's right. That's a saved phrase that exists sometimes for hundreds of years, you know. Like if you had two heads, you'd be twice as stupid or something like that. Yeah. And how somebody says that once and then it gets permanence. And then I'd say to them, right, give me more of them. And then I'd say, right, let's make one up. And then I'd say to them how writing is just saved talking. And so that would be one of the first exercises. And a lot of it is about demystifying writing, because it's this thing that's superimposed on them through the controlled means of the book and, you know, the syllabus. And then it's kind of saying, you're using this all the time. And that's actually what all of that is. Yeah. It's put into this book that you're reading for your Leaving Cert or your Junior Cert. But it's actually something more than that. It's freer than that. And don't let yourself think that doesn't belong to you. So a lot of the time it's actually about celebrating their own innate creativity that sometimes they don't see as creativity. So that would be one of my favourite things to do, is to get them to just to say things and then save those things and then start to deconstruct those things and sort of say, that's all we're doing here. And sort of capturing thought. Like I say to them, you know, I put a picture of a little girl chasing a butterfly with a net. And I'm like, that's all we're doing. We're just like catching the thoughts, catching the moments.
Okay. And at this point, are you getting them to write these things down that they're sharing in the class?
That would be just in a like throwaway kind of exercise. And it's a means to settle into the space. Yeah. And it reminds me actually like Mr. Cronin, my art teacher, like when we met him in first year. And he came in and he was like from Cork. And he was like, we're all going to draw a Zoomeringo. And I was like, what? A Zoomer what? And he's like, a Zoomeringo. You know, and he's like, you can be whatever you want. And he says, what's yours? You can have feet, you can have heads, you can have 10 heads. And then everyone who's had to draw, and I was like, this is mad. What's up? We can do whatever we want. You know what I mean? And the class, the energy in the class. Yeah. And I wasn't happy in first year. It was from a different area and it was really small. And it was hard for me to settle in, but I was good at drawing. And when he came in and he was like, you can do whatever, I was like, now's my time. And I just sparked into life. And I think that's the energy that I'm sort of bringing in when I start that first. And he was doing that because he knew what the young creative person needed. And he probably done that 10 times that day to all the first years. But like, we were like, oh my God, my life is transformed. You know what I mean? And I suppose I would have a very strong plan. I always have a plan. But then I love forgetting what I'm doing and going off on tangents. And that's my favourite thing to do. And afterwards, if I come out going, that went exactly the way I thought it would, it feels like I've just banged it out there. So I'm always trying to change it. That's how I keep the energy in it for me. So that's the kind of exercise I do at the start, or versions or iterations of that. Then the meat and bones of the workshop is always like about getting them into writing a poem. But I spend a long time talking about things and just life in general and the value of just being awake to what you're in and just saying, like, you're alive and all this mad stuff is happening and it's great and we should talk about it more. And I think in that part, you have to take on the responsibility of being the leader or the authority in the room and take that seriously and know when it's time to give them a break from sharing or being vulnerable and know when it's time to pull that out of them. Like, it's a long session that I do, it'll be 2 hours. There's always a time when you can feel the energy dip and you give them a while and then you kind of have to re-energize them.
So now they have a page in front of them and you're asking them to write. And in the icebreaker and in the conversation and so on, you have harnessed the energy and maybe you've given them a sense that what they have to say is something that's worth capturing on paper. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, or that it doesn't matter if it's not, that it's just something that they want to say.
Okay.
And I use this idea of elementopy. So elementopy is my word for the feeling you get when you hit the middle of the alphabet. And it's a sort of shorthand for the act of capturing expression as words, you know. It's like when you say the alphabet when you're a little kid, you're really afraid because you've been taught that it's wrong to make mistakes. And then you're tested on the alphabet. You have to express it. You have to say it out loud. And you're terrified about making it to the end without messing up. It's like jumping along stepping stones or trying to soar for something. And if we get this wrong, it's a big failure. But then when you get into the middle of the alphabet, the LMNOPB, that's where you forget what you're doing and you're just enjoying it because it sounds good and you're having fun. And the end is nearly there. And before you know it, it's over. So that's what LMNOPB is for me. It's just a way to talk to them about flow and fluency. Because a lot of times kids mightn't have emotional fluency because they don't have vocabulary. But then they mightn't have the fluency because they don't have the confidence as well. So the whole thing actually is about getting them out of the way of what they're doing and letting them just be fluent in expressing themselves. And I explained to them that when you're really sure of what you want to say, it comes out with its own natural energy. And I always share the example of Seamus Heaney's midterm break, where he wrote about this really powerful moment and then he saves it forever. And I talk about how our emotions drive our speech, and then how if you write that down, then that's a poem. And the more emotional it is, then you don't have to think about whether or not it's poetry, because you're just writing with all this feeling. And then when you're finished, I say, that's a poem. So if you write with feeling for 10 minutes about a thing that matters to you, then that's it. Elementary is my kind of way of talking about that to them. So I share examples, or I'd say to them, like, about losing your temper and how you get creative when you come up with new insults and all, or when you have to cry, or when you have to laugh, or when you come out with that forced joke. And then I talk about how when you're really passionate about something, or when it really matters to you, you're like a bird who has to sing. It's like this natural expression happens. You just say things because you're being driven to say them. And sometimes you say too much, you know, when you're telling someone how much you love them, it's coming out whether you like it or not. Yeah. And this might be the end of your friendship, but you have to tell them because you can't let it go without them knowing. And then I say, that's all this is. So then I say, well, let's find things that matter. Let's talk about things that matter to you. And then sometimes there's an opening up where we can just discuss a few different things. And I also sometimes give them the opportunity in an anonymous way, stuff that's really going on. Because I talk about, like, real writing is about sort of talking about things that we don't talk about all the time. Mm-hmm. Whether it's like how much you love school, you know, if you're a second year student, then you're like, oh, I love school. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go down the corridor shouting that to everybody, but yeah. That might be your only good thing in the day, being in school. And that might be controversial to say it, or like it might get you a bit of stick. So we talk about how you sometimes, like, poetry, art is an exercise in admission, you know. So we give them a chance to experience where the line is in themselves. And to sort of understand what they want to say and how that gets mixed up with what they're afraid to say. And then after that talk, it's like we've developed a sort of wellspring of things and issues. And then I'll ask them to talk about memory as well, important moments. And I'll ask them to talk about what they're passionate about and what they love. It might be like, what's your thing? And I might be like, I'm a footballer. Well, what kind of footballer? I'm a defender. So you're getting into them understanding their difference and their value in relation to everyone else. Comes from this thing that they know more than anyone else. Mm-hmm. And it might be, you know, they've moved house a lot, or they've lived in another country, or they're just really good at skateboard, or they can play music. And that's where their stuff is going to come from then. And then it's just creating a space to write. I might share some of my poems. And when I share my poems, that's me kind of going, look at me telling you things. Look at me being vulnerable. Like, here's me sharing some of my feelings. And here's an example as well of what we're doing. And I might talk a little bit about what I've done in the poem. I might say, oh, see what I did there? That's an actual phrase that I just made up. See, when we were talking about phrase at the start. And then I'll say, right, everyone, 10, 15 minutes, just write something.
So you've got them to spend 10 or 15 minutes writing, and they read over, I assume, what they've written.
We all share it. That's usually the idea.
Okay.
Depending on the time constraints, it might be the confident people who read, the people who don't want to read, I let them off the hook. But if I'm doing it right, everybody does it, because everyone then experiences the same vulnerability and everyone experiences the same empathy then. So they're like, I'm the audience, but I'm also the performer. And so when you're in the audience, I want to support them in the way I want to be supported. And then it just becomes this really nice room, because everyone's afraid and everyone's watching people doing it, and everyone's delighted when somebody succeeds. And then it's just this lovely cumulative effect. And there's a lot of things going on, I think, in that moment for a young person, because sometimes it might be their first time doing something like that. It might be the first time they've had a chance to speak in front of their peers for a long time, because sometimes there's a kid who might be the most sensitive, creative, imaginative person, never gets to open their mouth in class. So that's always a beautiful moment, I think, when that's democratized.
Mm. And when those students have shared their work and shared their experience through what they've written, is there any kind of polishing or redrafting or getting them to think about their work in a more rigorous way?
No, that's control. And that comes later. So my thing is, get up on the horse and go for a gallop, and you don't care if you fall off. And there's a sort of irresponsible, irreverent sort of messing about it. It doesn't matter. You know? And then off they do it. And there's so much freedom in that. Now, when they read that poem, I'll say, you just invented a phrase there that I've never heard before. And I'd show them, like, sometimes the hairs on my arms will stand up, and I'm like, look what you did to me. And I'd say, you just said something there. And that's what I'll say to them.
So every student gets some kind of meaningful
comment,
feedback.
A little comment.
Yeah.
And it might be how you read it. But it's all support. And it goes back to the kayaking, when you're watching somebody trying to get across the river. You've just taught them something and then they try it. And if you say, that's wrong, that kid might come back next week. But if you say, you just did that, you know, and you just acknowledge it for them. You pull the potential out of the kid by reflecting back on them what they're doing in a positive way, and they grow. So when the kid is like, I don't know if we can do this, I'm trying this poem, and then they read it, they get a round of applause, which is always a big thing, I think. And then I say, what you just did there was this, whether it's like nice rhyming there or it's something, and everybody gets something. Yeah. And it's really easy to overlook the value of that because you're doing it to 30 kids. But each kid is existing in isolation with their poem. That sometimes they don't even care about everyone else because kids are so self-centered in a terrifying way. They can't walk down the street without thinking everybody's staring at them. And when you say you just did something great there, that stuff stayed with me for my whole life. Kindness that came, like that, like the right comment at the right time, made me who I am. So I'm aware of that when I'm talking to them.
So can we talk a little bit then about your own writing and your own creative process?
I have habits or things that I go back to try and help me when I'm stuck. And I'd have routine. I have a place where I write. But I think a lot of the time it's just about the mindset as well. And one of the most important things is that nobody can take that time away from me. Like my family, they all know when I'm writing that it's serious. I just say I'm working. Could be sending emails or doing accounts or writing. It's just in there in that mix. But for me, I think one of the most important things is making the time and then taking the time. Sometimes you're taking that time to do nothing but wait for the thing to happen. And another thing in terms of process is important is don't wait for the right idea. You can write yourself into the right idea. Sometimes it's important to just be writing to start and to not be staring at a blank page. And even if it's like, I'm writing this down because I don't want to be staring at a blank page, then all of a sudden you're off.
Yeah.
And I think you have to get momentum in it.
So an example of an exercise that you might do to get yourself going.
One thing I always use is Pam Houston's Glimmers, which is 3 little 5-minute bursts of writing in succession. The one that she uses, and it'd be good to share with everyone, is you write for 5 minutes about something that happened in the past 24 hours. You write for 5 minutes about something that happened 10 years ago. You write for 5 minutes about whatever comes up. And you do those 3 in succession. And I've been working for nearly 3 years on the same thing. But even with that, the first thing I do before I even get started or go near it was do the Glimmers. Because it's like a warm-up now for me before I get into the real thing. It's like if you're in a swimming race, you have to start off by getting the body ready. And I think the imagination is like a muscle that you have to get ready with. So that's a good way for me to get unstuck. And then if I'm writing and I'm 10 pages into something and I'm stuck, I might try the Glimmers about that thing. Let's say, you know, we can think of when I was writing for Saoirse, the player role. I was like, where am I going next? What happens next? And then I just did the Glimmers. And I was just like, all right, so this happened. And then before I knew it, I was unstuck. So it's a nice little device and I use it in loads of different ways. Another thing in terms of process that's helping me now at the minute, Mary, is writing every morning. As soon as I wake up, just starting a little piece, starting a poem, or catching a thought, and that's been bringing nice results. And I think the thing there is as well, it's like the Glimmers have helped me to become fluent, and I think that's really beneficial if you let yourself just think about writing, think about what's on your mind, what's worth writing about for you as soon as you wake up.
So part of writing is getting unstuck and getting the thoughts down on paper, but then you need to go back and look at it again and decide what you're going to keep, what you're going to get rid of, how you're going to structure it. Is that the hard part or an enjoyable part?
Let's say if I'm working on a play or if I'm working on a story or if I'm working on a big poem, like a couple of poems recently were long poems that were commissions and they'd have parts. So structure is always on my mind, like narrative structure is always in my head. Sometimes I'm like, is this a clock or a lawnmower? What am I making?
So you're always thinking about shape.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with that in terms of story. Be writing it and saying, oh yeah, that's cool, I'm writing into this shape, and then I'm like, that doesn't fit, and then eventually all the shapes disappear and it just is its own thing, and then you're just making that better. The bits will have their own gravity and pull themselves together. And with poetry it can sometimes be that as well. So instead of 8 sections or 8 scenes in a play, you've got 8 lines or 8 stanzas, and you're like, where are they going? And then I'll be playing around with line length. I'll be like, wait, what happens if we hit enter there? Then it becomes a short poem. There's assonance there. Will I bring that out? And I'm always playing around with shape. I'm a bit of a tinker, or I think. I'll go back in and I'll keep at things. But that phrase that I got off Eileen Casey years ago, which stayed with me, was right with fire, edit with ice. So I try and keep those two things separate. But I think there's a level of self-awareness to being a writer where you sit down and you can't really shake the editor. You can't get rid of them. They're always there, but you just have to tell them to shut up for a while and stop judging. Especially when you're writing on a laptop, because you'd be like, this is a mediocre sentence. And then you're like, delete, delete, delete. And then all you have is, this is. And then you're like, that's even enough. And then you go back and then you've nothing. So writing longhand, I think, can be really helpful because it's harder to stop the momentum and you'll let yourself off the hook a little bit more. Whereas when you're writing on the computer, you'll delete. I think one of the ways to think about it is always like to try and maintain momentum. So any way you can kick yourself to keep going, I think is good. And then a really good thing to know is when to stop, because you can be too tired and you'll write yourself into trouble sometimes. You'll go the wrong direction. If I'm working on something big, sometimes it's like keep going no matter what. And then it's fixing that mess afterwards. But sometimes it's good to go, I'm tired, I'm not thinking right, not coming yet, and wait. And allow yourself to not have the idea yet. And it's funny because it's contradictory. Don't sit around and wait for the right idea sometimes. But also sometimes that's the best thing to do, is just sit on it, let it cook. And I've had loads of great instances where you just wake up with the answer after you've slept on it, you know, like the solution will come through your subconscious because you're thinking about it all the time.
We need to finish up. So would you share something from your own work?
And I was thinking that this generation is sort of free of a theocracy in the way that, like, my parents mightn't have been. I don't know who my real grandmother is, because my ma was given to somebody because she was handed away to get away from the shame of being an unmarried mother. And so this is called Love Bomb, and it just touches on that a little bit. The boy is a plank smashed into another boy's teeth. The boy is ripped open by street corners, broken beer bottle bits, rage vented on his flesh. The boy is a forced kiss in a piss-stained stairwell, the sun beaming in through slats. The boy is running in a pack to the top floor of the flats and howling at the seagulls. The boy is all of this, and a myriad of tiny miracles and cataclysms before 5 years of age. The boy is lost, pushing out through the concentric rings of the city's development, shedding skins and ideologies, never feeling at home, looking in on each new housing estate of mind with an outsider's bewilderment. Always haunted by a desire for roots and belonging until the girl comes along and the measurable want rings through his bones and quivers in his throat. The boy is with the girl, on the edge of the city, on a verge scorched by bonfires, on a manhole with grass-like green flames shooting out around it before the concrete gives way to the fields, back roads and hedgerows, daisies and dandelions, greens and whites and yellows of a hazy never-rained-on summer. The girl is raven-haired and blue-eyed, bright and gorgeous and full of fight. Crawling out from under an ancient shadow of religion and guilt and denial, the girl is orphans hoarse from crying, laundries and women in black with waste and womb spitting hate instead of love and fear instead of hope. The girl is history's river of vitriol, poured into her innocent mother and regurgitated into the present. The girl is the apex of an upside-down pyramid of hypocrisy and violence. The girl is a divine refusal to curl up and die. The boy has a token, a single sweet in his pocket. One pink love heart. He's been holding on to it since the tree wood stamped on a set of light as if his heart were a Halloween sparkler, fighting the night with everything he liked about the girl. The way he's desperate to touch her neck. The way he wakes thinking of her laugh. The way she makes his insides feel like a deep and dark windswept crater lake when she's near him and like a vacuum when she isn't. The love heart is heavier than a planet in his palm. The girl lies back. She watches a vapor trail cross in the blue bowl of the sky. From horizon to horizon, it's reflected in her eyes. The boy's blood pulses in his ears. He hears the rush of traffic, the swirl of water beneath the manhole he's sitting on, and he knows everything. Everything was leading up to this. He passes the sweet into the girl's unknown hand. She reads what it says, turns her slowly closing eyes away, places the words between her lips. Juices flow into her mouth, she spins the disc between her teeth, the boy's breath quickens, the girl's taste buds tingle, the sweet fizzes. And after a while, she turns back, catches the boy's eye, he leans over, and the girl is kissed by the boy. And from that kiss, two whole new worlds explode. It's mad to think of the absolute agony of being young and being afraid to show how you feel. And we can remember doing that, like handing someone love hurts, you know, with the words, I love you on it. Yeah. And then we're meeting them at that point of great agony and becoming, yeah, young people are like the ultimate protagonists. They're like making the world all over again, and they have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know.
And you capture the intensity of that so well in that poem. As teachers, we meet it every day in the classroom. And one of the things we've talked about here is how we negotiate that, or how we work with that with young people. So, Colm, thanks a million for chatting with me today. And look forward to working with you in Arts and Junior Cycle as well at some point during the academic year.
Deadly. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, which was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for Junior Cycle Talks podcast channel. To hear more from Junior Cycle Talks, search for us on SoundCloud or anywhere you listen to your podcast.